I'm David Schreiner-Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Wesley Hine. Wesley is the co-founder of Enigma Records, the label that discovered and put out albums by many legendary bands, including Red Hot Chili Peppers, Devo, Poison, and Motley Crue. He sold that business and moved on to become A&R for Disney's first foray into the record business, Hollywood Records. Then Wesley shifted gears and became a tech entrepreneur and consultant. Now he's the CEO of Master Channel, a new tech company that's launching a whole new type of business internet platform. Wesley, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, David. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, you've had a really, really interesting career path, and it sounds like you have done lots of different kinds of things, both in the technical space and in the entertainment space. Could you give us a short version of maybe some of your biggest successes?
Well, the current business I have is we describe ourselves as an enterprise SaaS, and what I'm probably most well known for is the record label, Enigma Records, and we did a lot of heavy metal and punk, as you had noted, and I think for many people, when they see my background on LinkedIn or we talk and they're going, how in the world did you evolve from punk rock to enterprise SaaS systems? And it does seem like a big leap. But the reality is that for most of my life, I've really been into two primary things, two primary markets, music and technology. And interestingly, the most current company that I'm involved with, Master Channel, it's a technology company, but our primary market right now, our primary focus has been music. So it's really sort of brought things together. But it's in, you know, if you don't mind, I know you said brief. It's always interesting. For me, my music business career started in a record store. And this is, of course, back when they did have record stores. Your younger viewers will be surprised to find out people used to buy music on pieces of plastic, and you'd actually go to stores that were dedicated to that. And it was actually quite the ultimate job one could get in high school, was working at a record store.
That's right.
And from that, however, I learned that records just didn't show up magically. They came from these things called distributors. And most of the distributors were major labels or things like major labels. But the really, in my world, cool records, the outside, the alternative, the punk, so forth, were coming from a small crop of almost ma and pa distributors. They were very inefficient. They were poorly run. And even though I was in high school, I could see that it just didn't seem like the barriers of entry were all that high. So outside, after high school, actually just after my first year of college, my brother, who had also been working in the record store, and another friend, and we'd all worked together at a music chain called Music Plus, said, it can't be that hard. And so we started. We raised a little bit of money, a very little bit of money, and started bringing in records from England and selling them to different accounts. And it became pretty successful pretty fast, honestly, because the barrier was low. It started off with just the three of us, and within probably 18 months to 2 years, we've had over 35 employees. We were profitable. We were dealing on a national basis. We were Polygram, UK, which is one of the larger record companies at that time in the UK. We are their largest export account in the world. And it went pretty well. Now, some of this had to do with timing. And I'm sure many of the guests on your show will say being in the right place at the right time is very important. But there was a big explosion going on at that time of music, punk rock, the beginning days of heavy metal. Major labels, major distributors didn't understand this type of music. And it gave a real opportunity for companies such as ours to enjoy that type of success. And out of that distributor, though, we learned that a lot of the labels we were distributing were similarly poorly run. And we're also undercapitalized. And we felt that we understood management, and we felt that we could get capital and we're profitable, and so we started our own record label. It really didn't come with a lot more strategy or strategic insight than that. We did see that as we were distributing other people's products, that there were other distributors selling those same albums, those same products. And if you're selling the same thing as the guy down the street, there's pretty much only one way you compete, and that's price. Because even if you tried to provide, you know, better service, that's just another form of price. And so we realized we really want to be the exclusive distributors of these, and the way to be the exclusive distributor is to be the label, is to own the intellectual property. So that's when we formed Enigma Records. Again, I think we benefited from many things, some terrific employees, some terrific luck, and it was just a wonderful time to be in the music business, the early, mid, and late 80s. And we all sorts of different types of music that were coming up and really interesting bands. You listed some of the ones before and many more. And it was a terrific time, and Enigma had a lot of success. By the end of the decade, however, the concentration was really coming to the music business. And what I meant by that was there were the large major labels. There were six at that time, and they controlled the distribution that got into the big chains. They had the big radio promotion departments. And they had. And then there were very, very, very small boutique record labels, independent record labels. And then in the middle were labels like Enigma, Geffen, Island, Chrysalis, and I could go on. And within a span of just a couple of years, every one of those was acquired, every single one of them. And what happened is that middle just disappeared. And so for a company like Enigma, we have about 140 employees. We either needed to grow dramatically faster, recede equally fast to go back and being very small and very boutique, or do what the other labels I had just mentioned and be acquired. And we chose to be acquired by Capitol Records. And we became, actually, technically, it was EMI, and we became a part of the EMI family. After the sale of Enigma Records, I then went on to the Walt Disney Company, who had been rumored to be wanting to start a record label for many years. And I was very excited when I got the call and was tapped to be one of the two people to start that, and it was Hollywood Records. And I ran that as the executive vice president for the next 4 years. And by this time, the middle 90s, and those who are in the music business crack up or are in the music business crack up whenever I say this, I was really starting to feel that the music business was not my future and really almost wasn't anybody's future at that point. And people laugh because this is still, that time period, I should say, was still very much the go-go days. You know, the apocalypse came 5-6 years later with Napster and the internet and so forth. And at this stage, still the traditional business models were working. But the concentration that I'd talked about in the music business, to me, had really changed the underlying dynamic. At Enigma, particularly in the early days, when we called retail, this is how we sold a record. Oh, you won't believe this record. It's great. You'll really like it. Person on the other end. Oh, that's fantastic. Can you send me a copy? I can't wait to hear it. We look forward to buying it. Less than 10 years later, here's the conversation. Oh, we have this great record. I think you're really going to like it. Person on the other end. Almost. So what? What's the deal? What's the percentage? What's the promotion? And I, having grown up in a business where we signed acts that we liked and we loved the music that we were doing, and even for the band, the artists that were not, or the genre wasn't necessarily my cup of tea, I loved being with them and I loved the excitement and the enthusiasm to something that was purely a financial transaction. And radio had become more and more and more important. And I just didn't feel like the industry was the industry and that I was comfortable in anymore. At the same time, I'd been spending a lot of time with technology. I'd been a computer science major in college. And I started going up as part of, while working at Disney, I'd started going up to Silicon Valley just to meet with different companies. And in those days, you could call up somebody at Apple, you could call Apple Computer, ask to speak to a product manager, say, I work for Disney, I'd love to come up and talk to you. And they'd say, sure, and you'd get a pass and go up there. And what I saw in Cupertino and throughout the valley, and as I started to meet venture capitalists, reminded me a lot of the music business at the beginning. You know, groups of very talented, creative people were getting together in these small pods, but instead of them being bands and garage, they were programmers, and they were huddling together and starting companies. And I realized that at that moment, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to a certain degree go back to the early days of the music business, but in this case, it was technology. And I helped start a company called Cinebase, Apple Computer, ended up investing in it. It was being incubated. by Warner Brothers Animation. It ultimately ended up being merged into a division of Kodak. I rejoined with my brother, who had been my partner at Enigma Records, and we started an internet company. This time it was called Enigma Digital. We were dealing with music again. This time it was online radio stations. We hooked up with a lot of our old friends from the music business. We had some good success with that, raised venture capital money, and that was acquired by Clear Channel Communications. Then I spent really the last decade primarily consulting. I did a stint as a CEO of a boutique e-commerce company focused on sports collectibles. And a few years ago, then I came across a company called Idea Den, now Master Channel. And I really, really liked the product of what they were doing. And the fact that their initial market was the music business was something that was just a terrific way for me to sort of re-engage with a lot of my old friends and contacts, yet still be firmly footed in a technology company.
Wesley, you've said some really interesting things. The first reaction I have is that, you know, you talked about being in the right place at the right time, but simultaneously to being in a certain place at a certain time, you also clearly understand how business works. And I'm sensing from your description that you've understood how business works from your first job at the record company.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a lot of things. And Malcolm Gladwell does, I think, a really good job in Outliers, that a whole series of things needs to come together. And being in the right place in the right time certainly is a critical component. Being lucky is. But you also have to love what you're doing, and it's hard work. And if you have to have some basis of knowledge. And business is business. And it's funny, at the beginning you said something along the lines, I think you gave me credit for being a problem solver. And I'm not sure I would ever put myself in that category. I think I probably have one, you know, sort of one thing that if I was to look back and feel good about, it's being able to identify the problem and then attract, manage, and maybe most important, motivate the right people who do know how to solve those problems. And I think that issue, that whatever you want to call it, focus or skill, is true whether you're a music publishing company or a vertical SaaS provider.
Yep. Being able to identify talent and being able to inspire and engage with that talent and being able to manage that talent, those are all really critical business skills, particularly if you're trying to create something that can grow into a company.
That's true. No one knows everything they need to. And honestly, anyone who thinks that's probably not going to be a good business person. So no matter what your strength is, if you're an incredible marketer, you're going to need finance, you're going to need production, whatever the, you know, vertical or the business that you're in, that those differences can be. But you really need to round out the team. And someone once told me, and I just have loved this quote, other than your love, the greatest gift you can give somebody is your time. So when you're building a company, you're building it with a collection of individuals who are making that very individual decision, do I want to be here or do I not want to be here? And so create understanding and looking at it from the point of view of all of those individuals, all those differences of where they are in their career and their lives and so forth, and creating an environment that they want to be at and picking the right people for the position. I don't really like sports analogies, but I always give them. But so this particular case, right, you know, having the world's greatest, you know, sort of point guard and having them play center is probably not a good idea. So it's not a matter of just finding good people and going, here's this. It's filling out the skills so that they're complementary and avoiding the normal pitfalls, or I should say the common pitfalls that hit, whether it's groupthink, people's inability to prioritize, inability or remaining, in some cases, just remaining beholden to a strategy that's no longer applicable under the misguided thing of, well, we shouldn't change our mind every week, so let's stick with this. Well, that's true, except in those situations where it's no longer true.
Wesley, you talked about reaching a point in your career where you realized that the music business wasn't your future. It sounds to me like you had reached a plateau.
Oh, yes, I think so. I was only, I think, 33 years old, but in some ways feeling a little bit burnt out. I had started working at the record store I think when I was 17, had just turned 17. So I'd spent 16 years in one industry and two jobs. And at that point, when you feel like you've spent, I guess, what would be my entire adult life in an industry, I yearned to learn different things. I'd always planned to grow my horizons. I didn't know what those were. Even when I was at Enigma Records and was president, I continued with my schooling. I continued to get my bachelor's degree in economics, and then I went on to get an MBA from Pepperdine University. I always wanted to be prepared for whatever it happened to be without knowing what it was to go through. So yeah, I think it's pretty safe to say that when I was leaving the music business, that I definitely had hit a plateau. I started to talk to a few other record companies as I was exiting Disney, and every job would be like, well, there's a head of international in Canada, or there's this and this. It was so uninspiring, as opposed to people going, hey, a couple of engineers saying, we have an idea for a product. We think it will work, but we're not sure. But if it does work, it's going to be huge. I was so much more interested and found myself thinking about that much more than any of the other things coming across.
So how did it feel to know that you had just spent, what is it, like 15 plus years in an industry where you suddenly realized maybe that wasn't your future?
Liberating.
Mm-hmm. Was it at all scary?
I don't think so. I don't think so. This goes back, of course, a few years, but I remember I took 3 or 4 days off and went to Arizona where my parents live, and they gave me a little place to work. And I just wanted to think about what I wanted to do, and I was still at Disney. I ended up taking more notes focused on technology. And at this point, it was multimedia and all of the things that were going on. And I think of, you know, I must have written 10 or 15 pages of notes. I think I still kept them at some point. Probably 2 or 3 were related to what I had been doing in the past, the recording industry. Everything else was on it. So to me, it was, everything was exciting. We started this new company, and within a couple of months, we're going to a trade show. And we were in the Silicon Graphics booth. Again, this will date this. There was a company called Silicon Graphics. And in the mid-90s, they were the hottest thing out there. Jurassic Park had just come out. And here I was in the booth demonstrating our new fledgling company and our new product. Probably as excited as I've ever been in my life. And people were coming up, of course, even though I understood our product and I'm there to demonstrate our product. They're coming in and they're looking at the hardware and asking how many teraflops and so forth. I'm like, I don't even know what a teraflop is. I'm sorry. And it just, I'd take all the notes. I'd write every question that people asked that I didn't understand. And that night I'd find some engineer or I'd find an employee of Silicon Graphics or whatever it happened to be. And I'd learn as much as I could. I'd write those out on cue cards. I would quiz myself and learn. I started taking extension classes and data communications at UCLA and consumed everything. Honestly, it had been years since I'd done that in the music business. Music business had become a job, I hate to say, those last few years.
Mm-hmm. That's often the case particularly with business owners. They feel like they become a slave to their business. Their business becomes a job. It's not a passion. They don't feel like they're running a company. They feel like their business is running them, and they feel stuck. And it's like, well, how do I get out of this? And I'm wondering if you have any tips in particular, because you seem to have done it. Do you have any tips in particular for ways to follow your passion, be open to opportunities? Because clearly you've been open to opportunities. It's not just that you've sought them. You've been able to embrace them when they've appeared, and do it at the same time in a way that can overcome whatever fears you might have about financial success. Because the truth is, people who are business owners, in general, they are following a particular passion, but they both want to be financially successful, and also they need to be financially successful. We all have bills to pay. So how do you follow your passion, be open to opportunities, and also, you know, in the background, know that you've still got to make money?
Yeah, well, boy, that's a very difficult answer, and I feel like if I had the answer, I'd be writing a book. But I'll share with you from just my own personal perspective. is the fear comes from the feeling that you might fail. Something might not work. It's not going to go through. And you just have to let that go and accept the fact that you kind of can't have everything. You can't necessarily follow your passion, have as much security and those sorts of things, any more than in business you can focus on all the things that you want to. And when you liberate yourself from that, and you go through and go, I think people, they toss and turn night after night going, is there a way I can do this and not take a risk? No, you're taking the risk. But the fact that what people have to understand is there's significant risk staying wherever they are. You know, I think that people who work at, and particularly today, working at large companies, isn't the risk-free thing that maybe it had been in generations past. And if you're going to a job that you're not happy, one, you probably are increasing your risk of heart disease and any number of different things. Anytime you just stop growing as an individual, you are going to be significantly at risk of all sorts of other things. The financial, sort of worries is just one of those. And any time that you're doing something that you're not passionate, and I'm not trying to be trite. No, we don't, you can have the best job in the world, and there's still a whole lot of things that will go on that are unpleasant, unfun, unmotivating, and that's just part of the process. But people know when they have something that's exciting them, because they can look to see what they think about when they're at the movies. Are they thinking about the movie, or are they thinking about that thing that they're going to do tomorrow? When they have when it's a weekend, are they working not because they have to, because they're doing something that's passionate and interesting? When they get together with friends, are they talking about work, or do they say, oh, I don't want to talk about that? Are vacations to escape or to recharge so they can come back and tackle the world? And people know the answers to those, and I think they know deep down inside. And for me, what happens is you just come to that and you go, okay, it's not a matter of if, it's when. It's not a matter of whether I'm going to do this, it's how I'm going to do it and to go through. And I've been very blessed because at the beginning, I started a record company. And I think, I always talk about opportunity costs. I started my first company and my opportunity cost was what? I was a college student. What was I giving up? Certainly some fun with friends and so forth and those kind of things, but I wasn't walking away from a pension and stock options and family and mortgage. And so my path is very, very, very different. But, as I got together with friends years later and, let's go 5 years into the Enigma path, I was making significantly less than my friends who had gone on the normal track. And they had gotten their college, jobs or degrees, gone off to whether it was to finance firms or to banks or to law school and all sorts of things. And I was making, in terms of cash, significantly less than probably every one of my peers. But I loved what I was doing and believed Enigma Records would be worth something at some point. And I just couldn't imagine any other path. And I think that's the thing that made the quote unquote risks go away, is you just can't imagine doing anything else. And so I think that getting back for the people to take the leap, I would never want to encourage somebody who's on the edge and their wife's pregnant with the third baby and they've got all the things going, hey, you have to go follow your dream. But at the same time, I wouldn't say, hey, you need to ignore everything and accept your lot in life and be unhappy. When I started to make that transition into technology, I spent several years, I was reading books, I was meeting with people, I was traveling, I was building, so that the day I made that switch, I had three different groups that wanted to do something with me, wanted me to join their startup, wanted me to go through. I didn't have that 6 month or year period of going, I'm eating through my savings. Now these startups, as anybody who's been involved with a startup knows, don't always involve salary. And in fact, you have to put money in. And that was the case in the one that I joined. But I also, again, had been lucky with my previous career in the music business with Enigma Records to be able to handle that. But I do think that when people make the decision that they want to go, that's the first step. Make the decision and understand it's not going to be, there's not a path by which that there's not some risk, because there's not a path in life where there's not some risk. And sometimes the riskiest thing to do is to do nothing, I should say.
Mm-hmm. And the path certainly is not linear.
Yeah. There is no such thing as linear in the universe, I'm convinced. Not to go all quantum mechanics on us, because I certainly couldn't speak to it. But people talk about successful companies and they feel like it started at point A, you know, and then it was just straight up like to point B. And you kind of want to go, you know, along the way, there were points that they probably thought they were out of business. There were points that the two founders were, you know, suing each other and forth. And there was a patent suit that could have taken them down. But the end result was good. And everybody, that's what everybody ends up associating. And it's really funny on exits, which is a very common term, of course, with technology companies, is the exit. So often the difference from most people's perspective of a successful company and an unsuccessful company is simply whether there was an exit or not. Because they were both probably losing money. They both had young founders that were unsure how to manage. There were 19 other challenges. But that one that did at least enough things right that needed to be done, that some third party came along and said, we need to buy you. We need you to be part of it. Everybody then goes, oh my God, what geniuses to go through. Somebody else could have done the exact same thing, but there was no exit. And alas, they're viewed as a failure. And one of the things I've gotten as I've had more and more experiences, I try, one, as we've talked about, not to think in things of linear because they just do not exist. The second thing is that I try not to apply labels like success or failure. To go through, because it just comes from too many different perspectives. Sometimes something can go all wrong, and that's the thing at a company. That's the thing that allows you to finally make the changes that maybe needed to be done, and then that leads to all sorts of things. And sometimes something's success from just out-and-out sheer luck. And you want to feel good about that, but it's probably not something that can repeat itself. And so, you know, putting it up on a pedestal and going, ah, look at what we did with this. Well, you know, just because somebody wins the lottery once by scratching the right card or whatever it happened to me doesn't mean that that's a person who's likely going to happen again. Got to go back to the same liquor store, do the same thing, and so forth. And Las Vegas, of course, has built very nice and large buildings with people feeling and attributing things that are truly luck. And random chance, and it's like, no, I was shaking the dice with my left hand, then I sneezed, and that's how I hit the point, and to go through. And so again, it's just something where we come through, try to take everything as an opportunity, try to take everything as, you know, sometimes I've been involved with things where it's a very challenging period, very challenging, and people are coming and saying, almost like, how do you sleep? Like, yeah, how is this? There's all this madness going on. Well, one, if you've been involved with startups most of your life, you're used to madness. But mostly, you know, I try to just go and say, if by the time I leave during the night, the company in some way was improved, some small way it was better, I'm probably going to sleep pretty well during that night, no matter what happens to be going through. If it's the opposite, that's where I get a little bit stressed.
Wesley, let's talk about some of those experiences you've had that we're not going to label as failures, but where things seem to be going wrong. But in the end, because you were trying to correct things, it had a very positive outcome.
Oh, yeah. There's a what's that adage? That which doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Right.
And I think that's very, very, very true. You know, there's probably so many examples and many, like human, it's probably our human condition to blank out many of the failures, regardless of how much they may have helped us later to go through. But in the early days of our distribution company, the music distribution company, we had 35 people and we were barely breaking even. And our you know, payables were due in 60 days, and you'd hit that 61st day and people were calling up and so forth. But we were collecting our receivables in 75 days. So you can see the flaw as it was going through. The more that our sales went up, the worse the hole got. But we were, because we were profitable, albeit barely, we were able to get a bank loan to fill that gap. And it looked like an investment to us because our sales were going up, our profits were going up, and this thing went through. However, due to a variety of things, a lot had to do with a recession that was starting to hit in the early part of the 80s. Capital was tightening, interest rates were going up, and so forth. Our loan was called. Now, even with this bank loan, line of credit coming in, things were extremely tough. And we got the call from the bank saying, in so many words, we want our money back. And now what they know that money doesn't exist. So what they do is they create what's called, anybody's ever been through this, it's hell, what's called a collateral account. As you collect money, you deposit it, and then you're allowed to write checks against it of about 93%. Basically, they take back 7% of your revenues or your collections to end up paying it down. Already things were tight. Now you add on top of that the fact that we are no longer going to be getting advances basically on the line. And on top of that, 7%, and our profit margin actually wasn't significantly greater than 7%, was going to be taken. Like, I just assumed it was a death sentence. And I remember walking out with, you know, my brother and our third partner and looking at each other and going, that's it. Like, you know, we came in today thinking everything was great. Here it is 2 o'clock in the afternoon and we've just gotten a death sentence. And there just wasn't any creative thinking. There wasn't, you know, this is the kind of thing we'll look back on and it's made us stronger. There it wasn't. But what it forced us to do is, as you know, probably a lot of your listeners are thinking, well, why didn't they just sit down? And that's the thing that really forced them to cut costs. Well, we thought we'd already running a lean ship. Well, evidently, there was more room for cutting. And we were able to go to the people at Payables. And now, with a lot more determination, it was like, we're not going to be able to work with you unless instead of paying you in 60 days, we're going to pay you in 90 days. But if you accept that, here's the type of business that we think we can give you over the next 3 years, and here's what we're doing. And you know what? Most of our vendors said yes. They didn't want to lose us. They didn't want to come in that day and go, wow, our largest customer just went away on something that we could have corrected. And it was tough on them. They turned around and probably had to make changes in their business. But the fact is we exited that process, and it took almost a year, a far stronger business, far, you know, everything, you know, leaner, more profitable, more successful, more determined. We lost some good people, unfortunately, in the process, and that wasn't lost on me. And I think I became a better executive and a better manager just understanding that process. And I don't think I've ever had something then come along, at least in business, where even when I'm looking and going, uh-oh, that might be it, that I didn't reflect back on that experience and going, maybe, maybe not. You know, it's so easy to feel alone in these things when you're running a company, you know, whether it's your own company, if you're a consultant or something, and you go, I don't have the answer, uh-oh. And it's like that old Ed Sullivan show. There was the guy with the plates and he'd be running around trying to keep them all going. And sometimes you feel like that. And as a business owner, you're trying to keep everybody happy. You want your employees to feel good so that they're working a successful company. The people who are lending you money, the investors, they need to feel people as good. You know, your wife who's made all these sacrifices for this, she needs to feel things are good, that doesn't have to worry. And you go through all these things, you can feel incredibly alone. And the thing I've learned is it's incredible how resilient individuals and relationships are when you bring them in and go, we have a problem and I need your help. What should we do? Generally, people do not run to the hills. And whether it's a vendor, whether it's a partner, whether it's an investor, whether it's an employee, manager, they feel really good that they got brought in. And people, for me, almost as a rule, rise to the occasion in those.
Very often, business owners are afraid to ask for that kind of help.
Yeah, and I think it's under this misguided thing that the way, when you start a business, by definition, you have no customers, no product, no money, no market, no brand. And who wants to work at that? So you go to employees and you're selling the only thing you have is a vision. You're raising money. You're selling the only thing you have most likely is a vision. Maybe you have a little prototype or whatever it happens to be, but and then this is going to be able to do this and this can be able to do this. You're going to customers who already have an existing way of solving whatever problem they have, and you're convincing them that this unknown, untested thing is better than that and that they should take the risk. Well, when you go on and on and on this, you get into this mode that everybody needs to feel good that everything's okay. And it becomes very hard to go and open up and say, hey, our biggest customer just said product's not satisfying to them. They're sending it all back. They're not going to pay. You know, how do you deal with things like that? How do you deal with your one key employee who had all the intellectual property says, wants to move back to Holland and these kind of things? And yet learning that when you go and you ask for help from whatever constituents you know, whoever's in your sort of like ecosystem, people are very happy to do that. First off, 99% of the time they know. Remember that first time we sat down with people and we said, hey, the bank got pulled. They're like, no kidding. The bank guy came in. You guys were in the meeting room. They left. We're serious. And you guys look like death for the next 4 hours. Like, you know, they just, people know. And letting them in instead of keeping up the pretense everything's okay. And no, nobody wants gloom and doom. You know, people want to be led, right? They want a leader there, but they also want to be, you know, sort of told the straight thing. And the balance of, here's the problems we have, I need your help. By the way, though, let's remind ourselves on the strength, right? The product's been well received, or this band is still doing well, or we're about to do this. It's worth the effort. Because if in your mind it's not worth the effort, well, there's another adage, right? And sometimes it's time just to sort of like cut the losses. And you know, if you look at the statistics, and I won't count them off the top of my head because I don't know them, but it's pretty safe to say the vast, vast, vast majority of startups do not succeed, end up failing within some number of years, some amount of time. And so you don't want somebody who comes in, gives it a shot, is playing with people's lives, you know, hiring people, doing all these things, and this is, it's not working, and pulls the plug. At the same time, if your underlying vision was incorrect and you cannot correct it, you know, you want to take the burden off the founder, the executive, or whatever, of going, no, this is a lifelong sentence. No, it doesn't mean packing up, you know, shop right that moment. It means opening up to employees, maybe doing something different, maybe trying to sell the company, maybe this, maybe 15 other things, but continuing to try to keep going it on and on and on and on in the face of what could be very clear evidence that's not going to work. You know, being an entrepreneur should not be a death sentence.
Wesley, thank you so much for joining us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest has been Wesley Hine, the CEO of Master Channel. Wesley, thank you.
David, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.